Hare Krishna. So the topic is my journey with japa. And thinking of the topic, I was struck first of all by the aspect of the journey. Life is a journey. And our life with japa is a journey back to Godhead. When I first joined, one devotee told me of a prayer that, "My dear Lord, you are so kind that as your holy name, you are my constant companion." So the holy name is our constant companion in our journey of life. But more than that, the holy name is really the power that will carry us to our goal, back home, back to Godhead. When the ISKCON Press first came to Boston, one of the first books that we published was Easy Journey to Other Planets. And Srila Prabhupada said that on the cover of the book, there should be a painting showing the Earth, and then, you know, the stars in the sky, the sun, the moon, and then at the top, Goloka Vrindavan. And there should be a devotee with, you know, dhoti and kurta and shika, flying through the sky from the earth on his way to Goloka Vrindavan, holding his japa mala. And that was actually the first cover of Easy Journey to Other Planets. And it's our mala, the holy name, that is going to carry us back to Godhead. When Sarvabhauma Prabhu mentioned that he felt his japa license should have been revoked because he was traveling in his mind, I thought of the Sanskrit word for mental speculation, which is manorata. Mana means mind, and ratha means chariot. So when our mind is wandering, when we're speculating, we're actually riding on the chariot of the mind. So we want to, well, of course, even then the holy name is there, but sort of in the background. We want to be more like, we want the holy name to be driving us. My personal journey began really the first time I met Srila Prabhupada. I did see the devotees once before I met Srila Prabhupada. They were doing Harinam Sankirtan at Union Square in San Francisco. And I was there that summer of 1968. And I saw them. I was seeking, but somehow I felt I was in a hurry. I looked at them, and well, I was struck. They were definitely different. But I don't know. I paused for a moment, but then I went on my way. Then that same summer in Haight-Ashbury, and I didn't know they were devotees. I didn't know what they were. You know. Then the same summer in Haight-Ashbury, I was walking down the street, and again, I didn't know he was a devotee, but later I understood he was a devotee. He was chanting japa. He was tall, he had a shaved head, and he was chanting japa. And again, I was struck, but there were so many striking personalities in Haight-Ashbury. I didn't think to approach him. But the journey really began in 1969 when I saw a poster on the university campus where I was a student in the Boston area with a picture of Srila Prabhupada saying, you know, Bhagavad Gita as it is, lecture by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. So I went. I had some disagreement with my friends leading up to my going, so I reached just in time for the last kirtan. It was in an auditorium that had bare brick walls. It wasn't poor. I mean, it was an opulent place, but it was just the style. And Satsarupa Maharaj was leading the kirtan, and Prabhupada was present on the stage, and there was so much potency. The sound was just reverberating off of the walls. There was just so much ecstasy. The whole atmosphere was surcharged, and devotees. People, students in the audience, started to stand up, and then one by one they started to go on the stage and dance with the other devotees in the kirtan. And I also felt like doing the same thing. But as it did, I had had quite a serious quarrel about my interest in swamis that was considered to be a disruption in my relationships with certain people. So I thought, if I got up and went on the stage and started dancing with everyone else, they'd really be upset. So I contained myself. And that was the first time I saw Srila Prabhupada. Then I got the address of the temple. The program then was Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Srila Prabhupada would speak at the temple in the evening. And Tuesday, Thursday, and often on Saturday, he would speak, usually at a university or some other public venue. And then Sunday was the Sunday feast program. So the first night, or no, maybe the second, in the kirtan, in the temple, they had a mantra sign on the wall. And the letters were English, but they were sort of ornate, and it looks sort of like Sanskrit. So I was looking at the mantra sign and chanting, and it was very ecstatic. Again, the atmosphere was surcharged, and I saw the letters of the mantra sort of dissolve and disappear, and then they would reappear and form themselves again. And because of my particular conception of spiritual life at the time, I thought that was a good sign. The mantra had potency like that. So then, maybe a week later, as I mentioned, Prabhupada spoke. I think the next was at the International Students Association in, near Harvard Square. And then he spoke again at Boston College. And during the kirtan, at the end, after the talk, the devotees got up, they danced in a circle. It was common, devotees would dance in a circle like that in front of Srila Prabhupada. And And as I was chanting, I just felt overpowered with feelings of love. First, for the people in the room, and then it was as if that sense of love just went through the walls of the room and to the neighborhood outside the classroom, and then further in the suburbs of Boston, and ultimately like embracing the whole cosmos. And I was overwhelmed. I mean, I had never really felt such love before. And after the kirtan, I approached Srila Prabhupada, and I'd never gone up to him before. I'd asked questions after the lectures, but I never really approached him, but I was just so overcome. I went up to him, and he was sitting like high up on a raised seat, and I said, I might have said Swamiji, because I don't think Prabhupada was current at the time. I said, "This is really wonderful." And Prabhupada, like, he smiled and he started to, like, to laugh. His chest was heaving, his body was shaking. And I knew he wasn't laughing at me. I knew it was transcendental ecstasy. And so he was just sort of chuckling for a while, and he looked at me and said, "Thank you very much." And that was, I don't know, I knew he was pleased. He was pleased that some new soul had come and experienced the holy name. And then, after some time, I asked for initiation by mail. And he wrote back in his initiation letter. I was initiated by mail. He wrote back, "I'm glad to note that you have experienced at least some of the bliss of Krishna consciousness." And just now I'm relating that to the experience with the holy name and the time I approached him. There was another profound experience. When I first met the devotees and Srila Prabhupada, I felt that everything about Krishna consciousness was perfect. And the holy name, the philosophy, the prasadam, the devotees were wonderful. Everything about Krishna consciousness was wonderful. But I didn't realize that Srila Prabhupada would ever leave Boston. When I met the devotees, he was there, and every day we saw him, and I just assumed that he would always be there. And then one day, the devotees told me that Prabhupada is leaving, and that they were going to the airport with him, and would I like to come? So I went with the devotees, and at the airport, almost all the devotees were crying, even the men. Most all the devotees were crying. And I started to wonder what is happening. You know, so I asked Arundhati Mataji, and she said that that on the absolute platform, that Srila Prabhupada had said that on the absolute platform, there's no difference between meeting and separation. Both are occasions of transcendental bliss. So as an answer, it sounded perfect, but still I had a doubt as to how practical it was. It was something I hadn't experienced. And it was on my mind, like, everything's perfect, everything's so perfect, but the spiritual master has to leave. He's not always there. And I was thinking about what she had said, what Prabhupada had said, but I wondered whether it was actually practical. In those days, we would go out on Harinam every afternoon. Later it increased. We'd go out in the morning and stay out all day. But we would go out every afternoon and chant for hours. And that was really a treat. Every Harinam Sankirtan we participated in was different. Remember once we went down one street, it was a little hilly, and there's hills in Boston, and the buildings were sort of close. I just remember hearing the sound vibration reverberate down the street. It was just so wonderful. And it was new. Devotees hadn't been, we were just starting to go out on Harinam, just starting to distribute BTGs. People had never seen us, and they were very curious. So every Harinam was really it was different. You know, we always wonder what was it going to be like this time, and sometimes we discuss our experiences. Like, there's a devotee named Nanda Kishore. He led the kirtan often because that's where Rupa Maharaj worked. He was in the welfare department. So Nanda Kumar was the main kirtan leader. And so he would share with me some of his experiences. And there was one tune that he sang. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Oh no, I think I got it. But it really goes. That's it. So that, the second Krishna is very elongated, and he was saying that, you know, it was really hard for him not to fall into Maya during that elongated ah. So that struck me. That's, wow. If you're not actually hearing the name, even while in kirtan, you could be in Maya. But I also wasn't sure if he really meant it or if he was just being humble, but it struck me. And the other thing is that I'm not so physically dexterous, so it really took me a long time to learn to keep beat with the cartels. And it would be, I mean, all the devotees were really nice. They were really nice. And it was such that I didn't even really realize I wasn't keeping the beat properly. But then I'd look and they would be sort of staring at me like, and then I started to think, you know. But I really wanted to play the cartels. But I stopped, or I'd try, but I'd be very quiet and I'd sort of look at their faces to see if they were looking at me. And then one day, it just happened. I could keep the beat. But Nanda Kumar, he would play the mridanga. I mean, I couldn't even conceive of all those different movements so fast. And he said, you know, Krishna does it. Krishna just takes over. He said when he tries to do it himself, he can't. At a certain stage, it'll get too fast for him to keep up, or he'll get tired. But if he just lets Krishna take over, then he can just go on and on. So anyway, after Prabhupada left, this was on my mind, what he had said about meeting and separation. And then one day, while we were chanting in front of the Copley Square subway station, tram station, and by that, because I remember I was playing the cartels, by then I'd gotten the... And I just felt Srila Prabhupada's presence descend. It was like so palpable. I actually felt Srila Prabhupada's presence. He was there. And then I thought, yes, what she said is true. That in the spiritual world, meeting and separation are the same. Both are occasions of transcendental bliss. So then, eventually I went to India, and became very engaged. But at a certain stage, I was in the Calcutta temple, and I would always feel that I had to chant 12 rounds before I did anything else. If I couldn't chant 12 rounds, I couldn't function. Later, I heard Mahatma Prabhu say that Srila Prabhupada said that if you don't chant all 16 rounds by 10 in the morning, you'll be in anxiety for the rest of the day. So that made me feel that what I was feeling at the time wasn't so bad. But at the time, His Holiness Tamal Krishna Goswami, who was the GVC for India at the time, he didn't like me chanting in front of the deities until I had finished my 12 rounds, because he wanted me to make appointments to meet people, to raise funds for the pandal, which was required. But I just could not function. I knew I just could not function unless I did 12 rounds. So I did a number between Mangal Arati and class, but not the full 12. And then after the class, I wouldn't have breakfast. I would just chant in front of the deities of Radha Govinda. And then I could function. And then, it's true, sometimes it wasn't that easy to finish the other four, but I felt I could do the, I could, you know, four rounds wasn't that much. I felt I could. But Tamal Krishna Goswami did not like it. And one day, he said to me, "You're just pretending that you like to chant in front of the deities. Actually, you just want to avoid work." So I took what he said seriously, but the thing is, I couldn't function without doing the 12. So whatever it was, I had to do it. And then, it finally came to the point where Srila Prabhupada wanted me to decide where I would do service. He said during the British rule, there were three provinces in India. Bombay province, Calcutta province, and Madras. So he said, which do you want? So I said, Srila Prabhupada, I'll just do whatever you want me to do. He said, no, I want you to decide. I said, no, you just tell me what you want me to do and I'll do it. He said, no, I want you to decide. And I had no way to decide. You know, I'd always just done what my authorities told me. This was in Mayapur. And from Mayapur, we came to Calcutta. And again, I was chanting in front of Radha Govinda because I knew the only way I would get an answer is by chanting and praying to them. So every day I would chant and pray to them, but I didn't get an answer. So finally, I thought maybe I will get Srila Prabhupada to give some hint. So I went into his room and I said, Srila Prabhupada, I've been thinking about it and I think I should go back to Madras. And then I gave all the reasons. And Srila Prabhupada said, yes, you can go. But I was testing him. I said, but then again, I was thinking maybe I should stay in Calcutta. And then I gave the reasons why I should stay in Calcutta. And then Srila Prabhupada, in the exact same tone of voice, said, yes, you can stay. So by then, I started to get this sinking feeling that this wasn't working, but I was already like committed to this strategy. So I went through it, and I said, but then again, I was thinking maybe I should go to Bombay. And I gave all the reasons why I should go to Bombay. And in the exact same tone of voice, he said, yes, you can go. So I realized he didn't fall for my trick. But I was glad, actually. I was glad that my spiritual master couldn't be tricked by some silly disciple. So it was back to me and the holy name and the deities. And eventually I got an insight. I should go to Bombay. And I wrote Prabhupada. But then Prabhupada left, and then I wrote him. He said, yes, come to Bombay immediately. And then I really got busy. Things really became intense. And I would chant. I liked to chant in the morning in the temple. But my experience of chanting was really eclipsed by my preoccupation with the service at hand, the whole struggle for the Juhu land. Though certainly the chanting kept me alive in Krishna consciousness, but it was a struggle. It was a struggle. Later, His Holiness Tamal Krishna Goswami said to Srila Prabhupada that sometimes he was so much anxiety over the whole struggle to get the land that he couldn't concentrate when he was chanting. And Srila Prabhupada said, yes, I know how you feel. I feel the same way. So it was like that. But then finally we got the land, we built the temple. And just before the temple opened, one of Srila Prabhupada's friends, supporters, devotees, Mr. P.L. Sethi, he approached us. He was the member of a Sankirtan Mandali called the Radha Madhav Sankirtan Mandali. They had a guru from Vrindavan, and every Sunday, they were all householders. Every Sunday they would meet at some member's house and they would do 12 hours continuous kirtan from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. And then from 6 to 8, they would sing songs from Vraj. So Mr. Sethi had the idea to do it at the temple. And this was probably maybe October of 1977. Srila Prabhupada was very ill. He was staying upstairs in his new quarters, but he was pretty much confined either to his bed or to his quarters. And the temporary temple we had with Radharasa Bihari was just beneath the building where he was staying. So anyway, there was this great feeling, outpouring of feeling from these devotees who were singing. And they knew that Prabhupada was upstairs and imagined that he was listening to them, and they wanted some personal reciprocation. But it was, you know, the lift wasn't working, so it would have been very awkward for them all to climb the stairs up to the sixth floor. And Prabhupada was unwell, he couldn't come down. So finally they came out of the temple room, not the temple room, the temple, and they were just doing kirtan. And he came out on the balcony. Like he looked down at them and he just acknowledged them. And they were delighted that they could see Prabhupada and get his mercy. And that was all we saw of Prabhupada then. Although later Mr. Sethi, he went up, and he said that at the end when they were singing the songs, when there's one lady, this was like the climax of the whole Akanda Harinam Sankirtan, is this one lady in particular, she would sing this song, Jai Radhe, Jai Radhe, Radhe, Jai Radhe, Jai Shri Radhe, Jai Krishna. And Mr. Sethi said that when she was singing that, he could see that, like, tears were trickling down Srila Prabhupada's cheeks. So then, the next day, went to Srila Prabhupada just to meet him, and he said, the kirtan was wonderful. And he said, we should do this every day. Do 12 hours Sankirtan every day. So I was so conditioned by the idea that we have to do service. I said, but Srila Prabhupada, if all the devotees do kirtan for 12 hours every day, you know, how will we be able to do the other service? And Srila Prabhupada thought for a minute, and then he said, all right, and what about Sunday? And I was relieved, oh, only Sunday, okay. And it was settled that every Sunday we would do 12 hours Kandanam Sankirtan. And later, I related the exchange to His Holiness Tamal Krishna Goswami, and he said that that was transcendental bargaining. that if Prabhupada had asked for 12 hours, you might have said, oh, we have so much service, we can do 4 hours. But he began by asking for 12 hours a day, every day of the week. And then when he said, well, all right, just on Sunday, then, oh, okay, we can do that. I didn't have that type of brain to think in those terms, but that's what he said, and it probably was true. So, that was really wonderful. That was really wonderful. All the devotees chanting for 12 hours together every Sunday, that was wonderful. And we would get so many realizations. So many things would happen when we did that. Things would change. And I was the temple president in Juhu, but it was such a thing that, I mean, yes, we always had to deal with problems, but by Thursday, when the problems came to me, I knew, okay, only 2-3 more days, we'll have the 12-hour kirtan, and they'll all be solved. So I would say, okay, you know, give me some time, you know, by Monday, I'll, and almost invariably by the end of the 12-hour kirtan, all the problems were solved. Either the devotees had some realization, the problem solved itself, or we realized it wasn't really a problem, and that went on for quite some time. Then when the new project opened, it actually was hard for all the devotees to participate for 12 hours because there was a lot of service. But at least the policy was every devotee should be there for at least 2 hours, at least. And the kirtan went on the whole day. And if you could spend more hours, you should. And that was also very nice. But as far as japa, my journey with japa, of course I should mention that there were some very critical moments in the history of the Juhu project after the temple opened. And the only way I was able to deal with them was by the mercy of the Holy Name. I mean, it was at one stage, the workers in the restaurant went on strike. And they had a lockout. Anyway, they were in the restaurant and they locked us out. And it was like really tense. We were very inexperienced. And we didn't even know all the politics that was going on behind the scenes. But how to deal with this? And I remember I'd be in my room and I'd just be chanting japa and I'd get all these answers what to do. And a similar occasion arose later where the workers went on a strike. And it was like that. I'd just go to my room and be so intense. Be chanting, and these answers would come, and I was like a general, like mobilizing the forces, which is beyond my usual capacity. And another thing, it was indirect, but I had this experience with His Holiness Tamal Krishna Goswami after Srila Prabhupada left, because for the first period, he was the GBC not initially. Later he became the GBC for Bombay, and so we would talk a lot about different issues, and sometimes I would feel that I was seeing something that he wasn't seeing. But he had a very strong personality. And he wouldn't, at the time, see what I was seeing at the time. But he was very serious about his japa. And again, almost invariably, and you could see it in his face, in his expression, it was a very deep experience for him. And then after that morning session of japa, then we'd meet, we'd have to discuss the day's activities and the plans. And so often, you know, he would come to see what I had mentioned in the discussion earlier. And then it came to the point, it didn't even bother me if he didn't agree at the time that I made the point, because I knew that during his japa the next day, if it was a valid point, not that my points were always valid, but that if it was a valid point, it would come to him during japa. And he was very, completely attached to Srila Prabhupada. And that was his mood when he was chanting, to be like guided in Srila Prabhupada's service, and covered in Srila Prabhupada's service, which he was. And so I think it's probably true of all of us that we get, you know, guidance and intelligence and inspiration when we chant in that mood of service. Although we shouldn't use our japa time to think about problems, but it just happens as a result that one is illuminated by the japa. But now coming to the more recent history, I was living in temples for about 30 years. I was living in temples. I attend Mangalarti, chant my rounds in the temple with the devotees. After Prabhupada left, often sitting in front of Srila Prabhupada's deity on the Vyasasana. But then in 1999, I had like a health crisis, and I ended up in California. I mean, that's where I was when I realized that I had this illness, and so I couldn't travel. But I would still chant. I mean, that was the main thing. I would chant in the morning. But Srila Prabhupada had instructed me to write. This goes back many years, early in my association with Srila Prabhupada. He'd instructed me to write, and I'd never really done it because of being so busy with other services. So I thought, well, maybe this is Krishna's arrangement. Now's the opportunity to write. And I found that I could write better early in the morning. So I started to write in the morning, and then I would do my rounds later in the day. And I think gradually the quality diminished. It diminished. And it was one of those things where I wasn't conscious of it. It was just happening, and I wasn't even aware of it. And then I read an article on the internet by a devotee named Mahatma Das. And the name of the article was "Put an End to Courtesy Japa." And I didn't even know what courtesy japa was, but I read the article and it struck me. It struck me. You know, we shouldn't just chant as a matter of formality because we've taken a vow. Of course, it's true, we have taken a vow, and we must chant our 16 rounds, but it shouldn't just be a formality. We should really pay attention. And then His Holiness Niranjan Swami came to stay with me for some time, and he was a very serious chanter of japa and kirtan, but a very serious chanter of japa. And he would chant 32 rounds a day. So I would see him, and I would, and it was in my mind, you know, that it's mentioned in the Bhagavatam that if you serve great souls, Sian Mahat Seva Vipra, if you serve great souls, you get the mercy of the great souls, and you develop the quality of the great souls. And first and foremost of those qualities is attraction for hearing and chanting. So I thought, well, this is wonderful. I can chant with him, and the scriptures recommend to develop taste that you should chant with someone who has taste. I can chant with him. I'll serve him. By serving him, I'll develop some of his taste. I thought, this is wonderful. And it was happening. It was happening. And then devotees kept, as I became more conscious of japa and the need to improve, devotees were mentioning the book by His Holiness Sachinandan Swami, The Nectarian Ocean of the Holy Name. And I had a copy. He was kind enough, he gave me a copy. But I'd looked at it, but I hadn't really read it. But it kept coming up. Devotees kept saying that they were reading it and benefiting from it, so I started to read it. So all these different factors started to focus on japa. And then, at the meeting in Dallas, maybe 3 years ago, related to the North American Strategic Planning Team meeting, Purusha Shukta Prabhu had the idea that there should be a spiritual care initiative. There's so many initiatives, but there wasn't a spiritual care initiative. So he proposed that there should be one, and he invited me to join the meeting, and I did. And out of the spiritual care initiative came the idea for the japa retreats and worship workshops. His Guru Maharaj, Srila Bhakti Tirtha Swami, is very concerned with the care of devotees. And then, as Mahatma Prabhu explained, His Holiness Sachinandan Swami, he also had his own realizations in terms of japa and had developed his own programs for sharing his realizations. So, Purusha Shukta came up with the idea to make the first effort of the spiritual care initiative japa retreats, japa workshops. And I still wasn't traveling that much. But anyway, to make a long story short, the idea was that Sachinandan Swami and I would hold one in Southern California. But that was the same year that Maharaj got sick and he couldn't come. But Purusha Shukta Prabhu didn't want to cancel it. It seemed like we would have to, but he didn't want to cancel it, which is to his credit. And as a result, we had the retreat, and there was no, like, one leader, like, or even two leaders. It was, like, very collegial. That particular retreat was all disciples of Prabhupada. It was, like, peers. And I was given some topics to speak on, and I I was reading, I knew I was behind in this area, and I was reading, the Nectarian Ocean of the Holy Name. And Niranjan Swami was still with me, and so I was focusing on my japa, and part of it was in preparation for the retreat. Because Burijan Prabhu always used to say, if you want to learn, the best way to learn something is to teach it. So I thought, I'm going to be speaking about japa, I better. That's wonderful. So, but that retreat, earlier Mahatma Prabhu said, expect miracles. I mean, what I got out of that retreat, I never could have imagined in a million years. I never could have imagined what I got out of it. Mother Yamuna was there too. She was a major influence, although she didn't speak much, but she was so serious about the holy name. And Ravindra Sarup Prabhu was there, and he really gave wonderful talks. I got so much out of his talks, and also just talking with him during the breaks in the retreat. And that was very special. But the culmination of it was the 64 round day. I really do hope that all of you will have an opportunity to attend a retreat. Because as good as the workshops are, they're sort of condensed into a shorter period of time. And of course, not everyone can take off for 5 days and attend a retreat, but if you can attend a retreat, it could be, one of the most profound experiences of your life. Because you get away from everything, no cell phones, no email. And for 5 days, you just focus on the holy name. Your whole intention is to deepen your relationship with the holy name. So I won't say too much about the details of the 64-round day. Maybe if we're together again at a retreat, I'll say more. But the realizations I had, I could never have imagined. And, things happened there that have directed my spiritual life or parts of my spiritual life ever since. And again, a lot was the association and the sharing of experiences and realizations. And so the next morning, we discussed our realizations and experiences from the day before of the 64 rounds. And that was very illuminating as well, very illuminating. But one part of it was how close everyone became. How close to each, we came closer to the holy name, and we came closer to each other, and really close. We were able to be so open with each other, and we became so attached to each other. Nobody wanted it to end. They didn't want the retreat to end. We didn't want to leave the retreat center. We just wanted it to go on. And after that, because I became more focused in my efforts to chant with attention. Having significant experiences while chanting japa became more common. Of course, relishing increases. Sometimes you just have taste, you just want to chant, and while you're chanting, you realize there's nothing else to do. Like Akino Thakur says, there's nothing to be had in all the 14 worlds. But sometimes you get glimpses into your existential position. So and again, I won't go into them, but they come as a result or in reciprocation for one's attempt to chant with attention. There was another experience, and this was also Krishna's arrangement, and I could see how Krishna was just making so many arrangements to help me. And that is that there was a couple, devotee couple, on an island in the Caribbean named St. Lucia. And, you know, they had invited me to spend some time with them, but I never could find the time. But it just so happened that year, after the japa retreat, I got a chance, and I went, specifically with the intention that I'm going to use this time, 16 days, to focus on my relationship with the Holy Name, to focus on my japa. So I went there, and it was wonderful. I mean, they're just such wonderful hosts. I didn't have to worry about anything. And I would just chant. They have a beautiful house overlooking the Caribbean, and I would just chant in front of Tulsi Devi. And the third day, perhaps the third day was Ekadasi. And I decided I'll do 32 rounds a day, and then on Ekadasi I'll do 64. So I was doing, you know, I did the 64 on Ekadasi. But then what happened was I got this tremendous burst of energy and inspiration to write. So then I started to write in the morning. Up until then, to chant 32 rounds in a day was easy, because I had nothing else to do. But now I was like writing from whatever, you know, 7 in the morning until noon, pretty much until lunch. And then after lunch, I would take some rest, and then it only basically just left the late afternoon and evening. And that was hard. That was hard to fit in 32 rounds then. It made me very conscious of how valuable time is. Because I couldn't miss the writing. I mean, that was extraordinary. And I couldn't miss the chanting. But there were only so many hours in a day. So I became acutely aware of how valuable every moment was. And especially to avoid talks that could be avoided. Because even if it's only 10 minutes, I'd have to think, you know, in those 10 minutes, I could have chanted one round. And if I save the 10 minutes to chant the one round, it's much better. If I waste the 10 minutes, then I'm going to have to chant that one round at the end of the day when I'm probably going to be tired. And then what's the use, you know? So I became very conscious of how valuable the time was. And I was able to do it. I completed my stay and I completed my quota. And then I came to Houston because the ticket was like that from St. Lucia to Puerto Rico to Dallas. So in Dallas, I thought, well, okay, now my retreat is over, and I'll be back to 16 rounds. And I thought, well, 16 is too little, do 20. So when I got back to Dallas, I was really struggling. Of course, the last day of my stay in St. Lucia, there was a hurricane. So they closed down the airport for 2 days. All the flights were canceled. You know, the electricity went out. But the next day was very good for Japa, I must say. Because no one was on the streets. You know, there's no electricity on most of the island. Nobody was at work. It's like, but anyway, I had to get my ticket rerouted, and I had a long stopover in San Juan at the airport, and I don't know, I was really struggling. So I would go to White Rock Lake to chant my rounds, and one day, you know, as I came around the lake, I was feeling like, this japa is useless. It's like shooting blanks. It's like it's not live ammunition. It's just like shooting blanks. It's like, it's no effect. And I was thinking of some of the devotees whom I had met in Dallas and how I wanted to help them. And I'd given them what I thought were good instructions, but they weren't able to really take them up. They wanted to, but they were just too weak. They couldn't really take them up. And I was thinking, you know, if along with the instructions, if there was more spiritual potency, then it would be easier for them to take up the instructions. And then I was thinking, you know, here I am chanting, I'm just like firing blanks. And I was thinking, you know, I could do so much more for them if I was more advanced in Krishna consciousness, which would happen if I chanted better, you know, came to chanting better. So I was chanting and suffering a lot, chanting and suffering. And I thought, well, I'm just going to keep chanting. And it was probably like what Tamal Krishna Goswami said. It wasn't that I was relishing the chanting. I just didn't want to have to go back to the temple and see the devotees. So I just kept chanting. And when I reached 32, I suddenly felt some relief. I felt some relief, and it became easier to chant. I was relishing. I could feel the effects of the chanting. And I thought, well, maybe I wasn't supposed to stop chanting 32. Maybe that was part of the problem. Maybe Krishna wanted to show me that I should continue to chant 32. So then the next day, I chanted, and sort of like an experiment. What would happen if I stopped before 32? How would I feel? Wasn't that good. Then I keep going to 32, then it was good. Okay, all right, Krishna wants me to chant 32 rounds a day, I'll chant 32 rounds a day. So then things changed. And things changed, and then we had the japa workshop here. And I thought, well, maybe I'm supposed to chant 32 rounds a day from now on. But it turned out not to be the case when I got back to California. I think it's really Krishna. I hope it's not just that I... But it does happen on occasion that we chant more. And I always do chant more than 16. And I read a letter from Srila Prabhupada where he says it's good for sannyasis. If they want, they can chant more than 16 rounds a day. But the quality is really more important. I mean, if you're chanting 32 rounds, but you're just saying, oh God, how am I going to get through these? It's better. If you can chant 16 good rounds with attention, that's enough. That's enough. Yes, I should mention one more thing within these last few months. There was the japa retreat in Joshua Tree with Mahatma Prabhu and Trivedit Prabhu and Yadavara Prabhu. That was also very good. And I had read another article by Mahatma Prabhu on the internet in which he said that attending a japa retreat isn't something that you do once and then you've graduated. It's something that you do regularly to just get away from everything and focus on your japa. And that's made sense to me. That made sense to me. This isn't something you do once and, okay, I've experienced that and I'm ready to move on. It's something you do again and again and again, regularly. It's like a regular fix. And that struck me, and it was wonderful, that retreat. It was different from the first one because it was a larger group, and but that was wonderful.
Can you share some of what you saw devotees going through, their realizations, experiences? Because that was, all the retreats I've been, I think that was unique.
I'll come back to that. But it was, and again, the culmination was the 64-round day. But there was a difference, I should mention. There was a difference having a larger group. Of course, it took a while for us to get to know each other. The smaller group the year before in Ohio was all Prabhupada disciples, God brothers and God sisters, and we pretty much knew each other, at least to some extent, and it was very easy to get to know each other. But here there were devotees whom I'd never seen. Some were new devotees. Many were not initiated. Some had been initiated but had difficulties. But something happened. And when the devotees were speaking, they all commented on it, that they felt a complete mood of unconditional love. Just like a mood of unconditional love where they felt that they could completely open up and share whatever was in their heart and be completely supported in their effort. At many times during the retreat, devotees would cry. There was one period before the 64 round day began, where Mahatma Prabhu asked the devotees to express what they wanted to achieve from the holy name, from the 64 round day. And, you know, it was such a wonderful mood that when anyone spoke, everyone listened very attentively. I was listening very attentively. And as they were speaking, I was making note of what their prayer was. You know, thinking if I could help them. And some of the desires might appear to be material from a certain point of view, but I didn't distinguish that this is material and this is spiritual, because it was coming from their heart in that very special atmosphere. Like one boy said, his father was in the hospital. He started to cry. Okay, it sort of came to me later, I'll visit his father in the hospital. And then one lady, she prayed that her son become a good servant of the holy name. And it turns out she had like a 6-year-old son. She'd never been to an ISKCON program. She was like completely new. She'd never been to an ISKCON program. When the devotees told the stories of how they came to the retreat, you can see how Krishna made arrangements. A lot of them had no intention to come, or they'd been invited to come, but they had some resistance and were doing whatever they could in their capacity to avoid it. But Krishna just forced them somehow by circumstances. So she, this was amazing, she had a friend who was a devotee. But he was a devotee who had gone through a period where he just lost it. He couldn't keep up his Krishna consciousness, and he wasn't following the four principles. He wasn't chanting his rounds. He just wasn't maintaining himself in Krishna consciousness. And somehow he met the lady somewhere. And even though he wasn't doing much as a devotee, but he was a devotee, and he gradually started to tell her about the Bhagavad Gita and Krishna and the holy name. And he wasn't even planning to attend. He was really out of Krishna consciousness. But he was a good technical person for sound systems. And, yeah. So they needed him to do the sound system. That's why he came. And then he told her, you know, why don't you come along? All right, I'll come along too. She'd never been to a program even.
I went to L.A. to do an introductory, like a 2-hour introductory, and she was just some guest at the temple. And my impression was it was like one of the first times she'd ever come. And I was talking about the Japa retreat.
Every single person there had profound experiences. So,
tell about the other devotee who drove the car.
One who prayed
for his father. Kevin?
Yeah, Kevin. You say.
So, Kevin was a new devotee. He was living in the Bhakta Ashram. I was staying in L.A. and I just stayed there for a few days to do some intro programs. And I was next to him in the room, so we would talk. And he was very resistant. And he's probably 50 years old. He'd been through a lot of other programs and So anyway, you know, I kept telling him about coming. He said, well, maybe I'll try, but I don't have money. And so I came back to L.A. to do the retreat a few weeks later and said, Kevin, are you coming? I don't know. I have the money. So Yadavar came through L.A. and he was going to the retreat and he needed someone to drive, although Kevin didn't know it. And Kevin just went up to him and said, do you need some help? And he said, yeah, I need someone to drive me to the retreat. So all of a sudden, there's Kevin at the retreat. And so what did he, was he thinking of leaving at that point? Or what happened? It was kind of like...
Because Kevin asked him to stay, and I, for a couple of days, I said, but you want to stay in a place for all the 5 days.
Yeah. Yeah, that was amazing. And then this other devotee that Maharaj was talking about, on the 64 round day, he went very deeply into, how should I say it, into, I would say he went in a positive way and very deeply into his guilt for having ever left Krishna. And he felt so bad that he had done that. And he felt so bad that he had neglected his sadhana, that on the 64 randas, for 3 hours he went to his room and he just cried. He said, I could not chant. And he just laid there and cried and cried. So what we see happening is when devotees are facilitated to chant this way, they go so deep that they really get on this deep level of their relationship with Krishna, as Mara said, in a way that never happens before. I mean, we're going to do as much as we can this weekend. But I was thinking today, Krishna's name, form, qualities, pastimes, they're unlimited. How far have we gone? Like sometimes when you chant, you kind of think, that's about it. You know, that's it. Doesn't, you know, 10 years ago I was there. 5 years ago, I keep hitting this wall. And the retreats are kind of, you break the wall open and go, oh my God. That's Krishna. So that's what we saw. And people chanting, breaking down, crying, relishing. Our godbrother Amoghalila, he was chanting on the 64 round day. And he looked like somebody. If you look at his face, he looked like somebody who you're feeding sweet balls. And then you look around the room and you see there's some devotee, Prabhupada disciple, female, she was a yogi. So you'd see her, she's sitting very straight. And she's like 3 hours, you know, he didn't budge. And she's just looking at the room. It's like, what's going on? And so what it does for me as a facilitator, what it has done for me as a facilitator, is it's built this intense amount of faith in the Holy Name that I didn't have. I didn't think the Holy Name could do what it did. And years before this, I was getting into the whole world of self-help because I wanted to apply that to Krishna. And there was certain things that I felt you could only get to through those means. You could get to him through the Holy Name. And then Krishna just said, no, I'm putting you as a facilitator of these, so you can see what happens. And I'm seeing people transform and seeing people break down. And just the other day, Manu, who takes the tours, I did a little program on Krishna.com, and when I was leaving, he said, I just want to thank you so much for doing this. He said, so many devotees have told me that the Japa retreat saved their life, their spiritual life. So, and it's not me, it's just what we see happening. So it's been an incredible builder of faith for me that the Holy Name, there's no wall there. It says we created the wall. We created the default setting. So we have our default. We're running wherever, you know, your wall is. Where do you want to set it? You want to set it here? You want to set it here? We can set it anywhere we want. So if for no other reason, you can come to a retreat and just observe everyone else. And by osmosis, become effective. I mean, we'll do that today. We don't want to minimize the effect. I mean, I've done workshops and people have major breakthroughs in workshops. No, not to minimize them.
Mahatma Prabhu mentioned our godbrother Moggallila Das. His realizations kept coming. You know, his breakthrough in his japa continued well after the retreat. and he would phone me, and he'd leave voice messages on my cell phone. It was Verizon to Verizon. And I saved all of those. I have like 8 messages from him. Like, one is more ecstatic than the other. And then it just so happened that his daughter was going to visit the University of California in Santa Barbara to see about getting admitted there, and also another university in Los Angeles, so they stopped on the way. And so in the morning he came into my temple room. He was chanting Jap. He's like smiling and dancing. It's like, and and for that period I also took a break from writing in the morning. I was also just doing Jap. And he came to me, although it's the rule, you don't disturb someone when they're chanting Jap, but he came to me like in so much ecstasy, and he said that it was actually hurting his face muscles to be smiling so much. So on my altar, like, I have a picture of Tamalakrishna Goswami, and Amoghalila Prabhu was also very devoted to Tamalakrishna Goswami. So he went back, he was chanting in front of the picture, then he came back to me and he said, Tamalakrishna Goswami said it's a matter of practice. If you practice enough, your face muscles will get stronger. And then he quoted how Prabhupada said that our austerity in Krishna consciousness is being happy. So, yeah, that was wonderful. But two other deep experiences just between Joshua Tree and now. One occurred when Purushottama Prabhu came. Like, he really works hard, he and his wife. I mean, I could see during the retreat just how hard he worked. And from Joshua Tree, he was going to visit his father near St. Louis Obispo. I thought, well, okay, he'll get a little break. So I asked how long he was staying, and he said, 2 days, which is not enough. But anyway, he saw my place on the way, and I said, well, anyway, if you ever have the occasion, you can stay here for a while. So after a while, he sent me an email saying he wanted to come, and the timing was good for us, so he came. So while he was there, I felt my job improved. And there's two aspects to this always. One is that in association your consciousness is elevated, and the other is that by serving devotees, you get the devotees' mercy, you get Krishna's mercy. So my job had improved, and then one day I had a very significant experience. I was sitting at the beach, and it had been building up, but at that time it reached the point where I just couldn't bear it. And that is feeling what other people feel. And basically what people feel is pain and anxiety under all the illusion, that's what it is. And so that's one would expect, especially with devotees or people that one knows. But at the beach it reached the point where I was just overwhelmed with the pain and anxiety of all the creatures. I mean, okay, there were a few people on the beach, but it was, you know, there's insects, and I was thinking, like, you know, how they're suffering. And then there were birds, like there were pelicans. Now, you know, superficially, oh, how pretty, the pelicans and the dolphins. But for me, it was torture. And, you know, the pelicans, they fly overhead, and then, like, I guess they see some fish or something, and then they just swoop down to get it. And I think, like, God, they're in so much anxiety. That's just right. They're all in so much anxiety. They're all in so much misery. And even the dolphins, they're struggling. A hard struggle for existence. They're just struggling to get food, and they don't know if they're going to get it or not. And, you know, the pelican swoops down. We don't know if he got it or not. And then he starts all over again. It was like, and then the insects, and it was, and then I was thinking, I don't think I can take this anymore. I don't think I can take this anymore. How much can a person bear? And then, and this is, and I'm chanting and all this is going on. And then I just had one of those profound experiences that some devotees have had of realizing that, you know, I'm not Krishna. You know, Krishna's Krishna. I'm not Krishna. And Krishna's in the heart of all, it was just so vivid, you know, he's in the heart of, with all of these living entities, with the sandpipers, the pelicans, the ladybugs, and the dolphins, and the surfers, and the devotees. He's in everyone's heart. And with it was this perception that sometime, at some stage, I wanted to become Krishna. I wanted to take the place of Krishna. And that like everything followed from that. My whole material existence followed from that, wanting to take the place of Krishna. And then I was thinking how, you know, as he says in the Bhagavad Gita, Suridam Sarvadehinam, he's the best friend of every living. And it was so vivid. We've heard it. We've repeated it. He's really the best friend of every living entity. Whatever body the living entity goes into, he goes with him. You know, he's their best. He knows more what they're feeling than I do. And I thought of something, again, I had heard when I first joined, that Srila Prabhupada said that only Krishna knows how nice you are, and only Krishna knows the volume of your suffering. And I think that it's really true. He really is the best friend. And then again, I thought of how Prabhupada said that the real friend is not someone who poses, I'm your friend. The real friend is he who tells you that Krishna is your best friend. And I became relieved. I became relieved. It's not that I became callous to the suffering of the living entities, but I realized more clearly what, you know, my position is and what Krishna's position is. And what I can do for the conditioned souls who are suffering. And I realize that Krishna really is their best friend. And that the best thing we can do for anyone is to tell them, you know, that Krishna is their best friend and that they should turn to him. And and to just sort of like trust in Krishna's plan for every living entity. Because as he says in the Bhagavad Gita, he knows everything. He knows past, present, and future. He knows all living entities, but no one knows him. So then that tremendous burden was lifted, and it was just clear, you know, things we had heard, but it was just realized in such a vivid way. And that also made a permanent change in me. And I think it's not a coincidence that it happened when Purusha Shukta Prabhu was staying there, because I think that the holy name was pleased that I was making an effort to serve him as a servant of the holy name. Serve the servant of the holy name. And so that's also very important, besides our own japa, to serve the servants of the holy name. But just a few weeks ago, His Holiness Devamrita Swami came to stay for a few days, and I had another, you know, experience, relatively deep experience, chanting japa at the beach when he was there. So I think that's also, that definitely is part of it, and I'm sure that as we discuss over the next days, we'll realize that the quality of our japa doesn't depend only on the effort we make at the time that we're chanting japa, but it depends on the quality of our whole life, what we do all the time that we're not chanting japa. And certainly serving the servants of the holy name pleases the holy name. And then the holy name reciprocates by allowing us to have a glimpse of the holy name and some taste of for the holy name, some glimpse of our relationship with the holy name and Krishna. So it's a wonderful journey. It's a wonderful journey. Hare Krishna. Are there any questions or yes?
Because we've gone an hour and a half, we take 10 minutes and then do questions, and then we'll have recital. Is that all right? A little break and then we do questions.
Oh, well, let's see. Questions. Let's see how many. Do you think there's going to be a lot?
Would you like to do questions and answers? What?
Let's take a few. We'll see. If we think there's need, we can take a break. Later.
It's a simple question. People don't like me asking questions. I always ask them the guru questions. Questions that have no answers. But
we'll take yours last.
This is not one of those questions.
Maharaj, when the person asks you the question, would you repeat it into the microphone so that they don't have
it? Yes. Okay, that's a good point. I did want to mention something because I thought maybe devotees couldn't hear what Mother Divyambar said about Bhakti Kevin. As Mahatma Prabhu had mentioned, Bhakti Kevin, you know, he was invited, but he was thinking, you know, he can't really afford it. And then Yadubara, he just went up to Yadubara. You can see again the connection between serving the devotee, serving the servant of the holy name. And then Yadubara said, well, actually, I need to ride to the japa retreat, and Kevin drove him. But even then, Kevin wasn't really planning on staying for the whole thing. He just thought, well, he just asked if he could stay a while. And then what Mother Divyambar said is she told him, if you're going to stay, you have to pay the full amount for the whole retreat, even if you don't stay the whole time. And then he decided, okay, I'll stay. I'll pay and stay. So, yes.
This question relates to something you said when you first had that experience of compassion. And I think it also relates to the last three things you said. Because it appears what's happening is something is coming beyond perhaps your level of advancement at that time. Or you know, you could feel it as a gift. Particularly the first one when you were saying you were feeling that compassion. So could you, less from a personal point of view, more from a philosophical point of view, how you understand that? Because the way you express that is a very, very elevated state. That was like the first or second time you were chanting. You were going very deep. So, you know, it seems that this aspect of mercy and, you know, our effort and our desire and so many things combined in the Holy Name can kind of work on us in ways that may be beyond what we are capable of achieving, or is it bringing out something that's already there? Is it fulfilling a desire, or how would that, you know, what, I mean, I can't say don't speak from your own imagination, but also
Mahatma Prabhu has asked a very good question that, you know, within the first week of meeting Srila Prabhupada and the devotees, I had that experience at the university where I was just overwhelmed with love for all living entities. So how is it that someone can have such an experience? Well, one answer is that being in Srila Prabhupada's presence, one received a lot of mercy just by being in his presence. Many devotees have reported never having even seen Srila Prabhupada and just going to the airport to receive him and then feeling ecstasy and crying and then and there on the spot deciding to surrender. So that's the influence of, and I wouldn't even say a pure devotee. I mean, certainly Srila Prabhupada was a pure devotee, but he was much more than just a pure devotee or, you know, more than just a Mahabhagavata. He was empowered to an extraordinary degree. Another answer, which I've heard expressed by others, is that in the beginning, Krishna gives you some special mercy to give you an idea of what waits ahead, so that you know that this is the goal and that the goal is attainable and you take up the process. So it's like to encourage the person. And another answer is that when we first join, we may be more innocent in the sense that we see, I know when I joined, I thought all the devotees in the temple were pure devotees. I saw them all as pure devotees. I didn't have any offensive thoughts about the other devotees. And Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu says that even a slight association with any of the five most potent items of devotional service, and chanting the holy name is one of the five, even a slight association with any one of the five is enough to awaken ecstatic love for Krishna. And the commentators on that verse, Jiva Goswami and Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur, explain that, or they raise the question, how is it that someone could have repeated an extended association with one or more of the five processes and not experience ecstatic love for Krishna? It's because they commit offenses. And they say that the truth of that statement, that even a slight association will awaken bhava, ecstatic love for Krishna, is that it should be done without offenses. And for whatever reason, it may happen that in the association of devotees, after a period of time, we start to see the devotees more from a material point of view than we see them in the beginning, which comes to, you know, on some level or other, committing offenses. And that's what prevents us from relishing association with Krishna in the form of the holy name or any other form. Once at my place in Carpinteria, near Santa Barbara, we had an evening program. There weren't many devotees, just doing kirtan. And just remember feeling like how sweet it is, how nice it is. I just wanted to tell everyone about it, how nice it is, and how they should just come and experience it. And I realized we weren't doing anything extraordinary. We're just having kirtan. And in the beginning, we experienced the sweetness, we relished the sweetness and appreciated the association because we were more innocent, less involved with offenses, especially offenses against other devotees. So, but one thing that the japa retreats and workshops can do for us is make us realize that the special experience that we had earlier, which might have been, you know, easier because of the presence of Srila Prabhupada or the presence of our spiritual master, you know, and the fact that we were innocent and we just wanted to learn, and we just wanted to learn from the devotees and follow the devotees and associate with the devotees. And even if after that other things happened and we couldn't maintain that level of experience, but we can get it back again. We can get it back again. And it's like Narada. In his previous life, Narada was born the son of a maid servant who, during the Chaturmasya, the 4 months of the rainy season, she was serving sadhus, saintly people. And after some time, she died of a snake bite. And Narada was only 5 years old, and she was all he had. Imagine a five-year-old boy. All he had was his mother, and she was gone. But he remembered the talks of the sages, even though he's only 5 years old. He remembered their talks. He had taken the remnants of their prasad. And so, to come to the point, he came to the stage where in his meditation, he matured, and in his meditation, Krishna appeared to him within his heart. And then he disappeared. And then he heard a voice, and Krishna said that because you are not mature in your devotional service, I regret that you will never see me again in this life. But that's not, but I think the idea that Krishna gives us something in the beginning to encourage us is true. And whether we experience the same thing again or not depends on our effort and Krishna's mercy. Nityananda Prabhu?
At one point, you made so many points that, you know, for eternity I could think about things that you said and go dive deeper and deeper into those points. But one point that affects me right now that I'm going to ask about is that you make this point that to serve the servants of the Holy Name gives us great potency in our own progress in Krishna consciousness. We can really very quickly progress in Krishna consciousness. We have that attitude of humble service and also serving the servants of the Holy Name. I'm wondering about the extension of that, whether that extends to thinking that all the persons that we meet, we see them potentially as servants of the Holy Name, that they're actually servants of the Holy Name. And then we serve them in that mood, that this is a servant of the Holy Name. And as you said, the other point that you said was the best friend is one who introduces Krishna. And in a sense, to introduce the Holy Name to that person and say, you're the servant of the Holy Name. Really, the Holy Name is your best friend. And you're the one who will provide everything. You're obviously looking for something in life. You want to be happy. As an enjoyer, I know that anybody wants to enjoy. Well, it's great to enjoy. Then, you know, you really want to enjoy. Here's the person who actually will give you the greatest enjoyment. Here's your best friend. Does that extend like that? Can you then? Or is that just like for looking for an excuse to associate with other people?
Nityananda Prabhu says that that if we see others, if we serve the other servants of the Holy Name will be pleased. But can that extend to people who are not serving the Holy Name, who are not chanting the Holy Name, that we can see them as constitutionally servants of the Holy Name or potentially servants of the Holy Name? And if we approach them in that mood, is that not service to the Holy Name? Will not the Holy Name be pleased? Yes, of course. But to maintain that consciousness, not just as a theoretical concept, one has to know that I myself am the servant of the Holy Name. And the first service is to chant the Holy Name. And our japa time is our time with the Holy Name. That's our main service, is to chant the Holy Name, to associate with the Holy Name. And it shouldn't come to the point, and it can and does come to the point where devotees are so busy with what they consider to be important service that they neglect their time with the Holy Name. Either they don't spend enough time with the Holy Name, or even during the time that they're chanting their rounds, they're not really with the Holy Name, but they're thinking about other things. So I think the basis is our personal japa, and that will extend to the perception that others are servants of the Holy Name. But the Holy Name has to be the central point. Yes, Mahatma Prabhu.
An aspect of this question is, our ability to chant the Holy Name affected by the degree of compassion that we have within us and also manifest towards others?
Just a practical point. I think it would be good to have a second microphone. I don't know if we can get something from the temple, but anyway. is our ability to chant nicely affected by our degree of compassion? It is, but it's also true the other way, that our quality of compassion is awakened by our attentive chanting. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur often emphasizes that as a result of offenseless chanting, one will naturally awaken to compassion for others. Because when you chant and you actually revive your relationship with Krishna, you realize what the standard of relationships is. You realize what the standard of happiness is. And then you realize that the people who don't have that relationship with Krishna and aren't relishing that transcendental happiness are, it's not just a theoretical idea, but you can actually see it, you can actually feel it. And then you want to help them naturally. It's like it's natural if you're experiencing something nice, you want to share it with others. So if you're experiencing the sweetness of the holy name, the beauty of the holy name, then naturally we want to share it with others. Whereas if we want to bring others to the holy name, but we ourselves are weak in our own relationship with the holy name in terms of our japa, it's not balanced. But yes, there is a relationship between the two. And that other verse, the Mahatseva Vipra, Vasudeva Kataruchi, that by serving great souls, by serving Srila Prabhupada and the previous acharyas, by bringing people to the holy name or bringing the holy name to people, we develop their qualities and we develop taste. So the two actually do go together. They complement each other. But you want to add something?
I was just thinking of that prayer of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Doesn't that prayer say, when compassion for all beings will enter my heart, then I can properly sing the holy name? Is that how it goes?
Yes. Yeah. That's correct.
I was sometimes thinking that that compassion means the open, the soft heart, and if it's not there, then we're chanting to Krishna, but perhaps the heart, Krishna can't really fully enter because the heart is hard, and we're not feeling what he's feeling for everyone.
Very good point. Very good point. What I said about that what we do outside of the time that we chant japa affects what happens during the time we do chant japa. I think if I had to sum it up in those terms, I would say it's the condition of the heart. In other words, whatever we do throughout the day or night affects the condition of our heart. And we want our heart to be open. We want our heart to be open to the holy name, to Krishna. And you know, if we commit offenses, it makes the heart close. If we engage in sinful activities, it makes the heart close. So that's a very important point that Mahaprabhu made. Sarvabhauma Prabhu and then Amarantra Prabhu.
Like many devotees have something like what you said in the beginning, some sort of a gift or an experience which encourages them in the world. I don't really understand much of what shadow attachment. It seemed like sometimes what he's just innocent and gets that association of someone that has a taste, but you said people come to Prabhupada. And so what is the difference between a shadow attachment and a more genuine type attachment? And does that What is the relationship?
Sarvabhauma Prabhu says that when we first meet devotees, we may have some positive experience of the holy name. And he used the technical term shadow attachment, which comes in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. But what that means is that by associating with pure devotees, one gets some experience of the holy name, some glimpse of the holy name. And so then the question is, what happens next? So if one cultivates the process of pure devotional service, then one will develop, you know, genuine attachment for the holy name. But if one does not follow the process of devotional service, one can still get some experience, especially in the association of pure devotees, but it won't be steady.
I'm thinking one time, like if you don't have your batteries not working in your car, you know, like someone comes give you a jump, but it's different from when you're it's working properly, and then you maintain. I don't know if it's similar, but it's kind of like.
That's a good point. Sarvabhauma Prabhu says your battery, you know, your car might be stalled, so you get a jump start from someone, but if you don't learn how to keep your battery charged, it'll run out again and you'll stall again. That's a very good example. Huh?
Buy a new battery.
Buy a new battery. No, you don't have time. I have a question. Why you are emphasizing on the holy name, which we say Hare Krishna Mahamantra, and by the same token, if we continue singing the songs of the God all day, and in between we recite the holy name, so how will it be effective? Singing songs or bhajans by God or the holy name of the God?
Amarendra Prabhu asks that, you know, we're advised to chant the holy name, Kirtaniya Sadahari. But what if we fill the day mainly singing songs about God and just in between chant the holy name? Well, the main process is to chant the holy name. Harinama, 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 Yivikevam. And I'm reminded by one incident, one exchange that took place between Parvati and her husband Shiva. Parvati had engaged in austerities, and as a result, to please Vishnu, that's the purpose of all austerities and sacrifices, to please Vishnu. And as a result, she was given the Vishnu Sahasra Nam to chant. So she had a rule that she would not take food until she had chanted the Vishnu Sahasranam. So after this determination, she came back to where her husband was, and he was just about to take prasad. And she said that she can't take prasad immediately because she has to complete Vishnu Sahasranam. So then Lord Shiva recited this verse that's recorded in Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita that by chanting the holy name of Ram, he is relishing transcendental bliss, and that one holy name of Ram is equal to the 1,000 names of Vishnu. So she chanted one holy name of Ram, she completed her vow, and she joined her husband for prasad. And then there's another verse that one name, three names of Ram is equal to one name of Krishna. So when we chant the holy name of Krishna, the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, we are chanting the holy names in the most concentrated form. And not only the most concentrated form, but the form that is given to us in the Shastra and by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself, as Krishna himself. So the other songs are wonderful. We do sing the songs of the Vaishnavacharyas, Narottam Das Thakur, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and others. But the main process is to chant the holy name. And it should be more that we sing the bhajans in between rather than that we chant the holy name in between. But one other thing that Lord Shiva said, I think we'll end the questions and answers now, but one other thing he said is that he has so much love for the holy name of Ram, so much attachment for the holy name of Ram, that if someone just starts a word with the syllable Ra, he thinks it's going to be the holy name of Ram, and he becomes ecstatic. So now, whenever we hear Rama, Ramada in, we should become ecstatic because of the holy name of Ram. Okay. Oh. Okay, one last.
I was in New York, upstate New York last month. I attended the retreat with Sachinanda Maharaj and Mahaprabhu. There I definitely had a transformation, but when I got back to New Orleans, I mean, wherever I live, I mean, again, life is again intense and I couldn't keep it up. I mean, so I was, I was so feeling so guilty when I saw Mahatma Prabhu. I was like saying, gosh, he's going to ask me, how are you doing? But when I was just thinking that maybe I'm so dead that it takes me a few hits before I get back to the chanting. Is that right? Or I don't know what to say, because I attended to the retreat, but it didn't really manifest what I thought I would, in my daily life.
What is your name?
Gopinath.
Gopinath Prabhu says that he attended the Japa retreat in upstate New York, but after he got back to his home in New Orleans, the intensity of life has overcome him and he's not able to chant the way he had hoped. Well, you did the right thing to come to the workshop. Earlier, Mahatma Prabhu quoted Sachinandan Swami that Srila Prabhupada said 90% of our advancement depends on the holy name. I had heard that Prabhupada had said 90% of Krishna consciousness is association. But the two are not different. And we need the association. And you know, this is something we'll be discussing before the end of the workshop, how to take back what we've learned at the workshop with us. But it's a constant factor that we require more advanced association. It's a constant factor. And as much as you need it, as much as you're able to get it, you should. But there are many aspects to how to maintain your japa in your home. But one thing we can all benefit from is repeated attendance of japa workshops and retreats and associating with more advanced devotees who do have taste for the holy name and chanting in their association and serving them.